Marcella Hazan, the noted Italian cookbook author, died this past weekend. She was a monumental, irresistible force, a cultural crusader of the best kind. She was opinionated, severe if provoked, and yet for a generation of home cooks, myself included, she became the Italian aunt we wish we had. The following comes from a 2009 interview with Marcella. Here in the KCRW studios, she remembered cooking dinner during World War II when she lived in Italy.
Oh, well, that was very difficult because aside the bomb, they were coming down constantly because we, unfortunately, we chose a place to be where we were very near, 3 miles only, from the head commander of Germany for Italy, and 2 miles from Mussolini went after he was rescued from prison by the German. So the alley, they were bombarding all the time. And the food was very scarce. It was impossible to find salt. You know, salt, you think that is very common thing. It doesn't cost almost nothing. But during the war, it was one of the most precious things. But, you know, it was a very, very strange way of living. It was not really at all a normal living. Because when we were eating, we were not sitting at the table with the leg under the table. We were sitting sideways. Because, and sideways, facing the door that took us to the shelter. Because when the bomb arrived, the airplane, we could run out without losing any time. But if by any chance we didn't have time because the bomb was coming down already, we were taking the dish and go under the table, but with the dish, because in the dish was the food. And keep it on the table, it was ruined by the plaster that was coming down from the ceiling from vibration of the bomb. So it was always very strange. You know, it was a completely different life.
Today's show begins with an ode to the women who taught my generation to cook. These aren't chefs. These are home cooks or teachers. They're extraordinary women who persevered in the kitchen under truly extraordinary circumstances. From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food.
So, here we go. Go.
No one understands egg yolks the way you do.
I want to speak to the person in charge of the cooking program.
I'm Evan Kleiman.
Leave the gun. Take the gun.
The first time Marcella Hazan came into Angeli, I was truly terrified. She was my mentor. I had learned so much from her books, and the idea of cooking for her had me almost completely paralyzed. After her meal, she called me out of the kitchen and told me, "You have real balls." I remember it so clearly. She said I had real balls because I served her green beans, braised until soft with pancetta and tomato, as she taught me, while all the chefs around me were still blanching them. My mom gave me Marcella's classic Italian cooking when I was 20. I used it until the pages were completely splattered. Eventually, the spine of the book just disintegrated. But by that point, I knew all the recipes by heart. The last time I saw Marcella was for this interview in 2009. She was here in the KCRW studios with her husband, Victor, who actually was the one to inspire her to start cooking.
Until I met him, I never thought about food. I was not interested in food, and I was just eating, that's all. But Victor was always talking about food, darling, and he started telling me what he had for lunch, explaining every dishes, and after he was telling me what he wanted to have for dinner. And you know, for a young woman in love with this man, but having this man talk all the time about food, I thought it was very strange. It was not really romantic. And, but, you know, that was Victor. And I loved it anyway. We came to America, and I never had to cook anything for human, you know. And I have this young man that was, food was so important for him, and I have to start cooking. And I didn't have anyone that I knew aside him in America, and I didn't know one word of English. Victor naturally took me first thing in the supermarket because so I could buy ingredient to cook. And the supermarket, I never saw one before. It was very strange. It was, everything was dead there. Everything was wrapped in a coffin. I never saw a chicken so dead in my life before. And the vegetable, they were wrapped, everything looked not real. And me, that I knew so little about food, it was really a problem. The only problem I didn't have, that I could buy without knowing one word of English, because I just look at the price and give the money. But you know what? I think that I didn't know that by osmosis almost, I had collect memory of the smell of the food that I was eating in Italy when I was young, not married, the look of the food, the texture of the food, the taste of the food. So at that point, I have to look something to help me to cook. And those memories came out little by little and helped me to do dishes.
Marcella Hazan is the author of multiple cookbooks. She died last weekend at the age of 89. If you've never cooked one of her recipes, go to the Good Food blog and look for my eulogy. It includes her iconic recipe for tomato sauce with butter and onion. One taste, and you'll really understand what an important culinary icon we've lost. You know, when I think about lineages in the food world, I feel that way too often we jump to chefs, who worked for who trained where. But for me, and for many cooks of my generation, it wasn't chefs, but home cooks and teachers who guided us through the kitchen. We didn't watch them on TV, we read their books. My next guest, Anne Willen, is part of this lineage. Anne has a new memoir out called One Soufflé at a Time. Hi, Anne.
Very good to see you again, Evan.
It's lovely to see you, too. You know, I've been thinking a lot since the loss of Marcella Hazan recently about a certain generation of women. You're younger than Julia or Marcella, but still you were part of a generation that mentored my generation. And I was thinking how adventuresome you were, that you didn't follow the trodden path of that period, which was to marry, have children, and take care of your husband and see that he had a career.
That's absolutely right. And certainly in England, where I lived until I went to France and fell in love with France in my early 20s, it was not socially acceptable for an educated young woman to go into cooking. It was regarded as a cop-out and a very odd thing to do.
Especially because then we're not talking about becoming a chef, could that even be in part of your brain?
Unimaginable. Women were not accepted in the kitchen, in a professional kitchen. I personally think largely because it was too hard work. But mixing men and women in a kitchen in all of that heat and steam and close contact, particularly in the large cities like Paris, London, where it's very close quarters, that's a complication. The French did not want to get involved with all of that.
So instead, you turn to what women in that period did a lot, which is teaching. But rather than teaching at a secondary school or an elementary school, you decided to teach cooking. Why?
Because I loved it. And I discovered late I cooked a bit at home, but my mother didn't like cooking, so we didn't have any of those bonding experiences in the kitchen. I love to eat. I've always loved to eat. So I said to my parents, look, stake me to 3 months at the Cordon Bleu in London, because I'd love to do more cooking. And when I got there, within a week, I knew that I had found my home.
Now, many of us have images of what the Cordon Bleu in Paris was like at that time from the movie Julie and Julia. Mm. Was it accurately portrayed?
To the last detail, that witch, Madame Brassin. I was at the Cordon Bleu in Paris for 18 months, in fact, about 10 years after Julia. It had not changed one jot.
Was your experience there what really drove you to want to open a cooking school, not in America, but in Paris?
Yes, it was, because they made it so difficult to learn. There was one chef instead of a great range of teachers. He didn't speak a word of English, so you had to speak French, which I had taken care to learn, so I was okay. But most of the students, the few students there were, didn't understand. There was nothing in writing. And I had that vision that it can't be difficult like this. It must be possible to make it easier.
There were no recipes?
There were no recipes.
So did you go home every day and write down?
Yes, I did. I had a little Olivetti manual typewriter and clack, clack, clack every evening.
Was it odd for an English woman to open a cooking school in Paris? Who were your students? What was your audience?
Well, naively, we'd envisioned some American students, foreign students, but French students too. Not a French person crossed the sill as a student. And we had wonderful support over here in the States, where my career had been developing over the last 10 years. And Julia Child was of enormous help and inspiration. She brought in Jim Beard, Simca, who, of course, was living in France.
Simca, of course, was one of her partners in the tome Mastering the Art. I found it fascinating the way you explained the difference between what you were doing, both at the school and in your cookbooks, and what Julia had done with Mastering the Art. Could you sort of describe the difference?
I think the difference is in intellectual approach, probably. I'm very interested in the background of things. And having been to Cambridge University, I'd been trained to analyze. So I automatically sort of think about why does something do something? And so I found France was fascinating because of the history of cooking, the regional cuisines that were very recognized and recognizable when you travel around. But then there's the classic cooking, which is all intellectual and kind of in the head and rather masculine. And then there's cuisine de femme, which is wonderful, more my sort of cooking, and Julia's, warm-hearted and by the fireside. And all of this gave such depth to, and still does, of course, what I write about and the different aspects of doing things.
You titled your school La Varenne.
Yes.
Why?
François-Pierre de La Varenne was the first French chef to write a really French cookbook, 1651. And in it you can see the structure, the bones, very small skeleton, but it's getting there. of French classical cooking. So there's bouquet garni, there's a kind of puff pastry, there are the beginnings of the roux-based sauces, and it all went on from there.
Anne, thank you so much.
That was lovely, Evan. Thank you.
Anne Willen's the author of many seminal cookbooks. Her new memoir is One Soufflé at a Time. A recipe for her chocolate soufflé is on our blog. Up next, the plight of the honeybee. Beekeepers are still struggling with the sudden disappearance of the bees in their hives. Find out what's to blame and if the problem is getting worse.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. It's time to check in with Laura Avery over at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. She's got the scoop on what's fresh and in season this week in Southern California.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I'm visiting today with Charlie Schaefer, who is the chef owner of Schaefer's Genuine Foods. That's a catering and event company based in Venice. Charlie's been a longtime shopper here at the Wednesday Market. And Charlie, tell us what you're here at the market looking for and give us an idea of what you're making with it.
Thanks, Laura. Well, today I'm here looking for some late summer, early fall vegetables. Tomatoes are great right now, squash blossoms. The other day we were here shopping, and we found some and just decided to play with them a little bit. And we did a little dish for some friends the other night, and we liked it so much that we're going to actually serve it a couple of times in the next week or so to some clients. So with a lot of the things we love to do, we love to start in a place where everyone's familiar with something like tomatoes and burrata, but put a little twist on it and do something unique. So what we did the other night was we took some beautiful, big heirloom tomatoes, which are really nice and meaty, shaved them really thin and made a carpaccio, laid that down on the plate, and then we took some squash blossoms and filled it with burrata and cilantro, a little lemon zest, and then just did a little tempura fry on them, and then just laid those right on top of the tomato carpaccio, and then finished that with a little currant dressing. The currants are great because it cuts through the richness of the tomatoes and the burrata and gives it a little bit of a counterpoint.
And what is the technique for getting all that wonderful filling inside that blossom?
The blossoms, you can just gently tear them apart, and you want to kind of go in and pull out some of the stem. You can just work slowly and delicately and just use a small spoon to kind of fill that little hole that you've made with the blossom.
Right, and then it all holds together in the batter. I know it's a very delicate thing, but I'm always amazed at when these things arrive at your table and they're perfectly stuffed and perfectly battered and crispy and just fabulous.
Right, well, you have to have the batter the right consistency and the oil the right temperature, and then it just comes out like a nice little package. Mm-hmm.
Does it need to be deep fried, or can you get away with like a quarter inch of oil?
You can get away with that, but it's a little more prone to misbehaving.
And tell me, is that oil then reusable? Can you use that for another day or so?
Oh, sure. You just strain it out, cool it down, and set it aside. You don't want to hang on to it too long once it's been heated, but you can use it a few times over the next couple of weeks.
And do you use olive oil?
Yeah, olive oil is great for that. Generally we use a mix of canola and olive oil for something like this. The canola oil gives it a little bit higher smoke point, but the olive oil gives it some flavor. So I think that's a good combination.
How long are they in that oil before they're done?
Oh, about a minute, maybe 90 seconds.
Hey, I know. Every time I go to a restaurant and I have one of those, I feel so special. So it's something that maybe we should all try at home.
Yeah, it's great. It's simple. It's tomatoes, it's burrata, but it's got a little twist to it.
Right. Sounds delicious, Charlie. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Laura.
That was Charlie Schaefer, and he's the chef owner of Schaefer's Genuine Foods, which is an event and catering company located here in Venice, which draws a lot of its inspiration from the Santa Monica Farmers Market. Talking about the squash blossoms that Charlie was mentioning, we have a few farmers here at the markets that do sell them. And right now we're talking with Casey Ritchie, who is the smiling face behind the Life's a Choke stand. And Casey, you've got gorgeous boxes of squash blossoms. They're super delicate. Tell us how they grow them, how they're handled, and how you get them here in such perfect shape.
Well, we actually grow them not only in an open field, but also in greenhouses because of weather concerns, so that we always have them available. We don't touch the flower part. We have to handle them by the zucchini end. And then we actually lay them in a bed of plastic and drip a little bit of water in every single one to help them keep, and then wrap them in the bag. So it's actually time-consuming, very delicate process, and that's how we transport them.
Okay, and so they're little tiny, you know, 3-inch zucchini attached to the bottom with the with this gorgeous blossom. Now, when you say you put water in, you put the water inside the flower blossom,
just
inside?
A sprinkle with the finger, the ranch hand just takes a little bit of water on their fingers and just sprinkles it in everyone. And 120 come in a case. So it's that's why I say it's time consuming.
Quite time consuming. And they're so delicate. Is there any way to wash them before a chef cooks with them?
I've heard that some rinse them. I don't think anyone really does, though, because they want to keep the integrity of the blossom. And so, obviously, you can rinse the zucchini, but I don't think most are doing that with the flower.
It's a big, delicate yellow flower. And inside that flower, there's those little stamen things.
Stamen, pedestal. It's really interesting because a lot of our individual customers in the public think that they need to remove that, whereas the farmer refuses to eat them unless that pedestal or staple is there because he says that's the most nutrition, where all the nutrition is and the flavor.
So more stamen, less cheese.
Well, yeah. I've been baking mine, even though I still stuff them with cheese, but most people do fry them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and you know, you said you have a greenhouse, and you have them a lot of the time. So are you going to have these pretty much continuously?
I believe that we're going to. Our plan is we forecasted through 12 months, and that's why we've done the greenhouses. We'll see what really happens, weather permitting. But as you know, we grow everything in Lompoc, so it's not too hot, not too cold, which is helpful. But this way, even during the winter, we should be able to produce them.
Okay, and how fast? I know zucchini is a real fast-growing vegetable, so how quickly turnaround do you have?
I think it's our only product that we cut every single day. So they grow overnight, literally. So every single day, the guy goes out first thing in the morning and cuts what produced overnight.
How do I store them when I get them home?
So when you get them home, the first thing you want to do is throw them in the fridge. Honestly, they're not going to keep more than 3 days, and that's even being cut the day before we came. So you really, it's very imperative that you cook them right away. But if you're going to store them in the fridge, and you can also, I had one chef tell me that he's taking a damp paper towel and laying them across the top and that's keeping them. I haven't tried that myself.
But you leave them in the plastic bag as well?
Leave them in the plastic bag, but the best thing to do is eat them as fast as possible.
Absolutely. Have your recipe ready to go. Bring them home. Cook them. Yeah.
That's right. And most popular is stuffing them, but I have a lot of customers that are getting them for putting quesadillas, soups, you name it. I mean, there's tons of things you can do with it. Pizza.
Oh, fabulous. Well, thanks, Casey. It's nice to know that they're available all the time. They are so incredibly delicate, and yet we're able to get them here. Thank you.
You are welcome.
That was Casey Ritchie. She is the smiling face of Life's Choke Farm at many farmers markets here in the LA area and describing the incredible process of bringing these squash blossoms to market. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
We've got a recipe for Charlie Schaefer's burrata-filled squash blossoms on our blog. Don't be scared of those squash blossoms. They're just a vegetable. Give it a try. And if you do, tell me how it goes. Leave me a comment on my Facebook page. Just search for me, Evan Kleiman, and click like. I'm really excited about an upcoming event we're doing, and I would love to invite you. On Sunday, October 13th, Ruth Reichel will be moderating a conversation on California cuisine, what it is, and why it matters. David Chang says it's just figs on a plate. But you and I know it is so much more. Sitting on the panel will be Roy Choi, Nancy Silverton, Sang Yoon, Joyce Goldstein, and Eduardo Ruiz. Join us at New Roads Theater in Santa Monica for a smart conversation on the history and future of California's food culture. Plus, of course, we'll have food trucks, beer, and wine. Tickets are on sale now, and you can find the details on the Good Food blog. Imagine, just for a moment, that you're a beekeeper. You tend your hives, and the bees are going about their business. Now imagine you come to check on your hives one day, and the bees are gone. If the bee disappears from the surface of the globe, man would have no more than 4 years to live. It's a rather alarmist calculation that's often attributed to Albert Einstein. And now more than ever, it feels imminent. Colony collapse disorder, or CCD, has been in the news for so long now that it's all too easy to tune out. But in reality, you should be tuning in now. The problem's getting worse. It's become so widespread that it was the cover story for a recent issue of Time magazine. Brian Walsh wrote the article, and he's here to explain why you should care about agriculture's unsung hero, the honeybee. Hi, Brian.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Yeah, we loved your article. Bees aren't native to North America, so where did they come from, and when were they first brought here?
Well, honeybees came from Europe. They came with European settlers in the early 17th century, and really, they followed settlers as they spread across the United States. I mean, often Native Americans would say that the honeybees would even precede the settlers. When they saw the honeybees, they knew the settlers were not far behind. And even before that, you know, in Europe and elsewhere around the world, I mean, human beings have been keeping honeybees in some ways for really thousands of years. They're one of those species, along with other domestic animals, that we've had a relationship with as long as we've really had agriculture.
You know, that's such an incredible visual because you sort of get this sense from a native First Nations perspective that as the bees would come across, then all of a sudden there had to be a different kind of flora popping up and a different kind of abundance was available.
Exactly. I mean, honeybees are responsible for really pollinating the ideas about one-third of all the food that we eat. So if you can imagine, you know, lots of fruits and vegetables, everything from apricots to zucchinis, if you want to do it alphabetically, honeybees play a big role in. And they allow us to have variety and diversity to our food. I mean, you know, the American diet, a lot of it is corn, a lot of it is meat, and that's not something that bees are involved in. But when you talk about the colors that are on your plate, the fruits and vegetables, everything that adds some flavor and variety to it, honeybees have been part of that. And they're also increasingly a part of big agriculture as well. You know, the biggest single use of honeybees today in the United States is the almond pollination in the spring in California, where you literally see billions of honeybees are brought from all around the U.S. to come to the almond orchards, help pollinate that crop, which is worth billions of dollars.
So at what rate are the honeybees dying now?
Last winter, we saw about a third of the colonies in the U.S. died off or disappeared, and that was about 42% greater than the year before. But really, since about 2006 or so, which is when you know, the term colony collapse sort of first came into the public attention, you've been seeing a loss of honeybees around that level.
So when you say they're dying or disappearing, describe the disappearing part. What happens? How does a beekeeper know that something is really wrong?
Well, when it comes to what's known as the classic, you know, colony collapse disorder, that CCD, that actually literally is the colony disappears. You show up often after the winter where your bees may have wintered away, sort of kept in a bit of a hibernate state. You go to check on them. They're gone. The honey's still there. The honeycomb is still there. But there are no bees, and you never really find them. And that's sort of the classic disappearing syndrome. And then there's more, you know, what's the sort of standard way of loss, which is where you simply see the bees weakened. You see a lot of dead bees around the hive. But you actually just see large levels of loss. And you see a loss of activity. I mean, when a healthy honeybee colony is a very busy place. It's loud. You see a lot of honeybees crawling on the bee frame. You see them buzzing around the hive. When you go to see a dead colony, it's going to a graveyard, essentially, for honeybees.
So what are some ideas of what is causing this collapse? Is it a pesticide? Is it a parasite? Is it a virus?
Most likely, it's a mix of all of those things. First off, you do have the parasites. There's one particular called the Varroa destructor, which is a great name, and it's a mite actually that came to the U.S. in the late 80s and really laid waste to a lot of honeybee colonies in the U.S. It's a little tiny thing that actually burrows into infant bee cells and kind of sucks their blood. It's almost like a vampire. And that's bad because it can kill them outright, it can weaken them, it can spread diseases like a dirty hypodermic needle would. So that's been a real problem. And they're very difficult to kill because, of course, it's hard to kill the Varroa mite without then killing the bee as well. Then you have the pesticide. There's a particular class called the neonicotinoids, and that's a new class of pesticides that sort of attacks the nervous system of insects. And there's some evidence that indicates that that pesticide may actually hurt bees even at levels that should be safe, at what are known as sublethal effects. It may actually interfere with their ability to navigate, their ability to fly. And so the fact that that's becoming more common is definitely a concern for beekeepers. And then on top of that, there's the lack of nutrition. Increasingly farms are these large monocultures that may run corn or soybeans or wheat. These are crops that are not – they offer very little nutrition for bees. Bees need a variety. They need wildflowers. They need wilderness. And if they're just surrounded by these large farms that only have corn, that only have soybeans, it's like they're living in a desert. So you weaken them with malnutrition, you weaken them with parasites, you weaken them with pesticides. It's not really surprising that they would be responding the way they are.
So beekeepers that are experiencing these losses year after year after year, how do they go about replacing the lost hives? And what kind of adjustments do they make each time they replace?
Well, the way to replace a lost hive is that you get a new queen. There are actually beekeepers out there who specifically raise queen bees. You can actually order them in the mail, bring them over. And if you introduce that queen bee into a surviving hive, eventually the hive will sort of split in half. It's called splitting your hives. Some of the bees, the worker bees, will go with the new queen. Some will stay with the old queen. And you can establish a new hive that way. Now, that's common practice. But the problem when you do that is that it takes a lot of the energy the bees could otherwise be putting towards pollination or be putting towards honey production instead goes to building up new bees, building up a new hive. And it's expensive. I mean, queen bees cost a fair amount of money. They cost $20-$30 at a pop. If you need a bunch of them, that'll add to your costs as well. So that's one way they've dealt with it. They've also looked to try to supplement the feed of honeybees. So rather than just relying on the bees going out there getting pollen, if there's simply not enough pollen out there, if you're surrounded by some either a monoculture or some sort of or pesticides, you can actually give them corn syrup. You can give them honey substitutes. But of course, that costs money. So that's more out of your pocket as a beekeeper. And then there's some evidence that just like it, high fructose corn syrup is not the best for human beings, it may not be the best for bees either.
Are there any alternatives to crop pollination? So if we lose bees, what happens?
As I point out in the story, in China, actually, they've had farmers hand pollinate some plants because it's become so toxic there that bees really can't survive. I don't see that happening in the United States. I mean, it's a very laborious process. There are some scientists at Harvard who have worked on robo-bees, bee-like robots that might be able to do something like pollination in the future. But in reality, there is no alternative.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Thank you very much.
Brian Walsh's cover story for Time magazine was called Plight of the Honeybee. We'll have a link to it on our blog. Coming up, Jonathan Gold stops by to chat about a new restaurant on Abbot Kinney, plus a new liqueur with a very interesting backstory. Stick around.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
Welcome back to Good Food. Jonathan Gold is with me now for a look at the ever-expanding restaurant scene on Abbot Kinney in Venice. He is, of course, the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, and today we're discussing Willie Jane.
It is a sort of low-country style, sort of southern restaurant opened by Govan Armstrong, who has been at so many restaurants in Los Angeles over the years and whose Post and Beam we like a lot on the show.
I mean, I'm sure that as you go through this menu, I'm just going to be very, very, very happy.
Really, all I have to say is shrimp and grits, isn't it?
That's true. And then there must be biscuits somewhere in there too, right?
There are biscuits. They're fluffy, slightly crisp outside buttermilk biscuits that they serve with this warm honey butter flavored with burnt orange peel. Grilled quail with corn pudding and wild rice salad. There is sliced super ripe height of season local peaches with burrata and smoked pecans.
Oh, I like the addition of smoked pecans to that. That makes it a little different from what we always see with the burrata and fruit.
It is. It's true that burrata and fruit has almost become a cliche lately, but
it still is really good to eat.
Every time you see it, you're so happy to see it.
So does Willie Jane have an enormous menu?
It's not huge. There's about, 10 appetizers and 10 entrees. They have a really nice brunch, too, for which all I have to say is chicken and waffles. I like chicken and waffles more than I like most things.
I like chicken and waffles, too. What else really impressed you there?
There was a salad of grilled shrimp and watermelon, which doesn't, on the face of it, sound that great. But the watermelon is served with this tart, they call it Benny seed, but I think that's the same as sesame seed dressing. So there was that freshness and the juice and some really nice greens that went with it. It was just a wonderful dish. One of the things that's interesting about this place is that it sort of has a relationship with Cook's Garden next door.
What is Cook's Garden?
It's a garden. It has programs. It has teaching stuff. They obviously grow things. But it means that they have, you know, that they have lettuces and tomatoes and kale and peppers and, you know, everything seasonal coming, no farther than, you know, 50 feet to the kitchen, which is nice.
That's sort of extreme locavorism.
Exactly.
Now, what about the wine list? Is that kind of interesting at this place?
The wine list is all Californian or mostly Californian, and it's fine. It's not a wine list that's going to have people driving across town specifically for it, but you know, I mean, if you have a bottle of Flowers Perennial Red in front of you in one of the, you know, extraordinary brine pork chops, you're going to be really happy, I think.
So let's go back to those extraordinary brined pork chops.
They are brined in sweet tea with a little bit of salt, which obviously gives it, a bit of sweetness and a little bit of an herbal thing in it, and it caramelizes when it's cooked a bit. Usually, to me, brine pork chops tend to turn into sort of junior ham.
Interesting.
That they have the firmness and a little bit of salty flavor, but it doesn't really become interesting. And these are interesting. They're good. They're juicy and definitely worth eating. They come with a big heap of wilted greens and the smear of what they call date mostarda that I could probably do without, but there you have it, you know, acidic spiced dates. The fried chicken, as you'd expect, is good. There's nothing about it that might differentiate it from other fried chicken except that it's always juicy and the crust is nice and there's a little bit of black pepper in there. It's just fried chicken done correctly, which is nice to see.
And on the brunch menu, when you get to have it with waffles, how are the waffles made? Is there any, like, little tweaking, or are they pretty straightforward?
They're pretty straightforward waffles. They're nice. They're very light. They have a crunch to them. I can't imagine buying a cookbook for this restaurant, right? But you're really happy you're there because the preparations are good and people are happy to see you. And the food is well prepared. If you're going to have, you know, some baby carrots on the plate with your hanger steak, they're going to be cooked down a little bit, charred. They're going to be interesting in themselves as baby carrots instead of just like a throwaway. If you're going to get, you know, oxtail, it's going to be big rounds of oxtail that are carefully braised and fall apart at the fork and come with some grilled plantains, but they are just oxtails. If you got them at, you know, one of the, you know, soul food restaurants in, you know, Compton or in Willowbrook, you would be really thankful that you were eating oxtails that were that good, but you wouldn't think that these oxtails came from anywhere in particular. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah, definitely. What about desserts?
The best dessert there, which you wouldn't expect, is a kind of cookie sandwich around mascarpone cream. They're oatmeal cookies, and they're so rich, and they're so chewy, and they're so good. And the cream is sort of like this mellow thing in the middle that sort of prepares you for the next bite of cookie. It's some of the best cookies I've ever had.
Wow.
And if not that, there's always the strawberry shortcake.
There you go. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Jonathan Gold, the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Willie Jane on Abbot Kinney in Venice. You can get a text message with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's recommended dishes by texting Good Food to the number 69866. That's Good Food to 69866. Plus, you can always find all the restaurants that you hear about here on Good Food on our restaurant map. Check it out. It's on our blog. You may have noticed last week that a bunch of little huts covered in palm fronds started popping up on some front lawns throughout the city. Those are called sukkahs. They were there for the holiday of Sukkot, a Jewish holiday that involves a lot of sleeping, eating, drinking, and general hospitality in the hut outside. Another ritual element of the holiday is the use of a very large piece of citrus fruit called an etrog. I've always wondered if people eat them or what happens to them at the end of the holiday. Well, it turns out some people are turning them into liqueur. With me are Howard and Marnie Witkin. They're producing an etrog liqueur. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having us.
How long have you been doing this?
Informally for 5 years, 6 years. And commercially, we really hit the market this summer. But we've been doing it for 5-6 years as our friends demand every year, make me more. And more people show up at our house with their etrog saying, can you turn it into liqueur for us? And when the store owner started saying, turn it into liqueur for us, we decided to turn it into a product.
What fruit is an etrog?
It's a very ancient citrus fruit, rare, grown in maybe 5 places in the world.
What is the English name for it?
It's a citron mentica. And I mean, in English, it's generally known as a citron, but it's not, I mean, again, like everything else, there's varieties. What people see as like a citron that goes into a citron vodka is a close relative to this, but it's not really, it doesn't have the same floral sense as a real etrog.
Etrogs are extremely fragrant, and my understanding is that picking them out for Sukkot, for the ritual use, is a specialty and that they can be incredibly expensive.
The amount of labor and perfection that grows in, that goes into producing the perfect etrog fruit. If you go to the orchard and you look, every fruit is held from touching any other leaf or spine, and they're wrapped in foam, and they're sheltered by shade. And when you go to pick an etrog, you're looking one for the perfect shape, and there can be no blemishes and no spots and no nicks and no cracks because you're trying to do what's hidden. You're trying to make, you know, the practice to be beautiful. So they look for the most beautiful piece of fruit, but it's a tremendous amount of manual effort on the part of the grower to get that perfection.
So are you looking to these same fruits for your liqueur?
They are the same fruits.
Those fruit that don't have the perfection visually to be the $75 or $100 piece of fruit for the holiday, so those fruits come to us, and then we turn them into the liqueur.
So, you know, a lot of people who listen to Good Food, a lot of foodies in L.A., have gone out and started making their own limoncello, which is a liqueur flavored with lemons. This seems along the same line to me.
It is in that it's also a citrus-based liqueur, but, you know, your typical limoncello is, you know, bottled down at a 15, 18, 20 proof. So this is a 38 proof, 76% alcohol, right? It's a limoncello is generally, if you look at it, it's not even a translucent. It's almost an opaque. The way it's produced, you produce an opacity. Ours is a beautiful translucent, and we're really just pulling the fruit esters and oils and the aromatic, right? The aromas out of the fruit.
Yeah, it's more fragrant, and it's a beautiful flavor. I just took a sip. It has a very, very beautiful flavor. Do you tend to drink it neat in a tiny little shot glass, or do you like turning it into a cocktail?
All of the above. It's great neat, a little bit of ice. It's wonderful over vanilla ice cream. I've used it to infuse baked goods afterwards. The holiday, also Rosh Hashanah that we just had, honey cake is very popular, and I adapted a honey cake recipe and used it in the cake and then mixed it with honey as a glaze to saturate the cake. That was delicious.
Yeah, that must have been really good.
Makes a great mixed drink with gin and rosemary.
And we find that most, even if we drink it neat, mostly people seem to want to drink it on the rocks. And the difference is, you know, it modifies that proof point. So you're starting as a very, very strong spirit at 76. You know, in a 30 milliliter, you know, 1 ounce shot, even a milliliter of water changes that proof point. You know, so the person can kind of find where it fits their taste and where the aromas open up.
Yeah, it's. I just think it's such a great idea. How do you make it? Are you a distiller?
So we are what's called a rectifier. So we start with an alcohol base, a very, very pure 192 proof, you know, pure cane sugar alcohol base. And then we have an proprietary extraction method that we've kind of worked out over the years of how to pull the aromas and the esters and the oils and the aromatic oils out of the fruit without pulling out the pith and pulling out the bitterness. So we do the extraction. And then once we get it to, you know, proper flavor and aroma and smell of the pure alcohol with the aromas, then we sweeten, try and again maintain the proper, you know, legal proofs. And once she thinks it tastes right, then it's ready to bottle.
So this is all handmade. We make it in batches and barrels. Each bottle is labeled so you know where it came from and which barrel we were working on. And
right, we've taken to labeling every batch, and within the batch is every individual barrel. Because you pick up, you know, there are half a dozen different varieties of etrogim, and we blend those etrogim to try to get the flavor balance. But every barrel just has a slightly different aroma and flavor and essence to it. So we've taken to actually numbering and lettering the barrels. So if you like, you know, 7306F, get another 7603F, because 7306A
it will be
is
going to
be wonderful, and it'll be similar, but there's like slightly different high notes. And
now I understand that you're also making another liqueur that has as its inspiration another sort of ritual aromatic that's used in the Jewish religion. Could you describe it?
So we call it basamim, which is Hebrew for spices, and it is an aromatic spice liqueur. And if you've ever had Havdalah at the end of the Sabbath, there's certain spices that Jews smell. It kind of represents you feel like you have an extra soul. It's a set of smells that's supposed to elevate your soul. So we've taken that spice mixture, and again, you worked on extracting the aromas and turned that into an aromatic liqueur.
So it has notes of cinnamon, cloves, hint of vanilla in there.
That would be an amazing base for cocktails for the holidays.
It also bakes well.
Oh, I bet it does.
Yeah, it's great in your gingerbread. And
well, thank you so much, you two.
Thank you for having us.
Marnie and Howard Witkin are the husband and wife team behind Sukkah Hill Spirits Liqueurs, which I should mention are both kosher and kosher for Passover. Check out our blog for a list of where to buy their etrog liqueur. Coming up, do you think you could eat on just $4.50 a day? We'll hear from a chef who took the SNAP challenge next.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
Welcome back to Good Food. How much do you spend on groceries each week? What about per day? Think about it for a minute. Now, would it be possible for you to eat on $4.50 a day? That was the question that the San Francisco and Marin Food Bank issued last month. It came to be called the Hunger Challenge, or sometimes the SNAP Challenge. Bob Brenneman is the organization's development director.
The Hunger Challenge is a challenge that we put out from the food bank asking people to live on $4.50 a day, which is what people who live on food stamps, that's basically what they receive as their benefit. What we added to this year's Hunger Challenge is that it made the experience very close to the people who benefit from the food bank, who go to our pantries. So we also made sort of a simulated pantry here at our food bank. And so we invited people who are taking part in the Hunger Challenge also on the Monday, the beginning of that week, to receive some groceries just as they would receive if they went to one of our pantries. And they could use those groceries to supplement the $4.50 a day they would have to spend on other food.
One of the participants in the Hunger Challenge was Lincoln Carson. He's a pastry chef at Michael Mina's Restaurant Group, and he took the challenge with his wife. I caught up with Lincoln on the phone and asked him to describe his experience, starting with his first Monday morning.
The challenge started on a Monday, and the food bank, the pantry that they set up, was distributing food late Monday morning. So I still had to plan out Monday breakfast and lunch for two people, and preferably, you know, plan out dinner. So I did a lot of comparison shopping on Sunday.
And do you usually do comparison shopping?
Never. And You know, it may not be fair because I'm not sure that someone who's on a $450 a day budget is going to comparison shop either. You know, it opened my eyes to what was available, what was good, and what was not good.
How so?
Well, I mean, I made certain assumptions going into this that, you know, maybe a really large chain grocery store would be the one to go to and get the best deals at. And, you know, I went there. I went to a local farmer's market. I went to Whole Foods, which is where I shop a lot. There's a big, really large one in my neighborhood in Oakland. I went to a local grocer who's known for having an incredible selection of produce. And what I found was that the really big chain store didn't have the best deals, and frequently their food was of inferior quality.
Now, I'm really curious. You're a chef.
Mm-hmm.
So you have skills, like you could buy a whole chicken and cut it up. You could bake a loaf of bread. Did you decide to utilize those skills to make the food go farther?
I opted not to. I tried to make it realistic. I mean, I could have baked a loaf of bread, but you know, I opted in the end not to and used a good portion of my budget to buy a loaf of bread, actually. It was $5, I remember. It was a tough purchase. Big percentage of what I had to spend.
Why did you buy a $5 loaf of bread?
It was actually an accident. We were looking at bread in the store that was labeled at $2.99 on the shelf. And we found a whole grain, multi-seed bread that looked like it would be nutritionally very valuable. It was on that $2.99 shelf, and we took it up to the checkout with everything else we had, and it was $4.99. So at that point, you know, we said, well, you know what? This is reality. I guess we ought to just swallow the bad choice on our part.
Before you went to the store, did you strategize how you were going to make meals that would satiate you the most? Like, did you think to yourself, well, I'm going to rely on legumes, or I'm going to rely on really cheap protein?
I pretty much took protein off the shelf. You know, one of the other tough choices I made was buying some bacon. And I bought bacon, it was $4.99, but my thought was that I can use the bacon for the cooking fat, and I can use it to bring some flavor to what would otherwise be a lot of really bland meals. I mean, I think it's possible that you can put food in your stomach for $4.50 a day, but can you put quality food that is going to be nutritionally abundant for you and still taste good in your stomach for $4.50 a day? And that's really pretty tough.
Were you preparing three meals a day?
I was.
Wow, that seems really hard. So give me an idea, just sketch out what a breakfast, a lunch, and a dinner would look like.
Well, I mean, the saving grace was what we received from the food bank was a lot of produce. It was probably 60, 70% produce, and we received a dozen eggs. So that opened up a lot of possibilities. So breakfast was, I found that when I ate at home, and I get up pretty early, and then I go to work, I wound up hungry earlier in the day. So we try and wait until the latest point possible to eat breakfast, which usually wound up being 10:30 or 11 in the morning. And it was usually just some fruit, piece of toast. We had bought some really cheap yogurt, plain yogurt, mixed fruit in with that. Lunch one day, tuna fish sandwiches, another day, leftovers from a dinner the day prior.
And what were dinners like? A lot of pasta?
One night we did pasta. Had some fresh vegetables that I had bought at the farmer's market. Zucchinis, had an onion from the food bank. A little bit of bacon went into that for some flavor and really helped it out a lot. Pasta, I remember, was I think 89 cents a pound. So we cooked half of it for that meal.
As you were doing this, were you sort of constantly aware of how much you knew compared to what the average SNAP recipient probably knows about food and nutrition?
Absolutely. I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head with that. I think education in food and for people to understand how to make a nutritionally dense meal that tastes good, that's not going to be expensive, is something that's probably missing in this whole system.
How often did hunger intrude?
First couple of days, it actually did. You know, because I think I was trying to, you know, okay, it's important I have my breakfast because I'm not going to get anything to eat until lunch. I can't just go and snack. I stayed away from family meal in the restaurant.
How important do you think family meal is to some of your lower hourly workers?
It's a great point because the first day that I didn't get family meal, I realized, you know, we've got a couple of prep guys and a couple of stewards who you'll see loading up their plate, like piled high every family meal. And it's a meal they receive for free. It's just part of working in the restaurant. And frequently they'll take the leftovers home after everyone's done portioning out for themselves. And it made me realize, you know, these guys are supplementing their income with that meal. It's very important.
Thank you so much. It was really great talking to you.
Yeah, as well. Thank you for taking an interest in the challenge.
Lincoln Carson is the pastry chef for Michael Mina's restaurant group. He and his wife took the Hunger Challenge, attempting to live on SNAP benefits and groceries from the local food bank for a week. You may have heard that the House of Representatives voted last month to reduce federal spending on food stamps by $40 billion over the next 10 years. If the Senate actually passes this legislation, no doubt a much greater strain will be put on our local food pantries. The Los Angeles Regional Food Bank is one of the largest in the country. Michael Flood is CEO and president.
The cut, if it does go through, would have a huge impact on pushing more people into the food pantry and charitable food program lines. And that's troubling for us because while the food bank brings in and distributes more than 1 million pounds of food each week, the demand for food assistance is much higher than the supply of food that we have. You know, we serve 650 other charitable agencies throughout LA County. We have more than 800 agencies on our waiting list. So that gives you an idea as of today, while we're distributing 1 million pounds of food every week out to the community, the demands throughout LA County are much higher than what we're able to provide today.
Wow, that is so dramatic. Well, thank you so much, Michael, for taking out this time for us.
Thank you.
That was Michael Flood. He is CEO and president of the Los Angeles Regional Food Bank. We'll have a link to you to enable you to donate to the LA Regional Food Bank. It'll be on our blog, kcrw.com/goodfood. I'd like to give you another quick reminder to go online now to purchase your tickets for the upcoming panel on California cuisine. Ruth Reichel, former editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine and former food critic for both the New York and the LA Times, plus author of many wonderful books, will be our moderator. It's a special event not to be missed, so just head over to kcrw.com/goodfood for details so you can purchase your tickets. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find Good Food on demand on KCRW's apps for the iPod, Android, and BlackBerry. A big thanks to the Good Food team. That's Jillian Ferguson, Laurel, Sarah, Harriet, Ronnie, and Gary. I'm Evan Kleiman. Join me back here next week for another delicious edition of Good Food.